Hi, my name is Matt Fernley, editor of Battery Materials Review, and here's all the key news in the world of battery materials this month. Welcome to April's slightly delayed edition of Recharge, the podcast by Battery Materials Review. Lots to talk about this month, and Cormac's been travelling all over the world. So without further ado, I'm delighted to welcome my co-presenter, Cormac O'Leary, MD of Electrios Energy, to give us some insights into what's going on in the battery sector in Asia. Hi, Cormac. How's it going?
Hi, Matt. Very well. How about you?
Yeah, good, thanks. Good, thanks. And you've been around and about Hong Kong and various Asian countries. Now you're at the Fast Markets Conference in Korea. What feedback from your travels? Anything exciting?
Very good trip. Got to take a little deeper look in the Indonesian nickel mine sphere down in Indonesia. So a quick successful trip there. And Laos, as I mentioned, for copper, which is a little bit outside my field, but a pretty good trip to see.
You go to more mine sites than I do these days. There's something wrong with that.
yeah. It's the listenership, I guess.
Nobody wants to invite me to mine sites. Come on, guys. Ante up the invitations. I like to go and play with rocks as well.
You're going to get dirty.
Great. And China and Hong Kong, what do you hear from the Chinese battery market?
Chinese battery market, yeah, it's picked up a pretty good March in terms of battery production. So kind of blew out what we saw in February with the Chinese New Year. It's always a bit of a complex time to make predictions on the state of the battery market, right? With big pickup in March, I think close to 75 gigawatt hours. I remember when we passed 50 gigawatt hours monthly production, it wasn't too long ago. It looks like we're heading towards 100 gigawatt hours.
It's quite scary, isn't it? It really is quite scary, the magnitude. The real big question is sort of that comes up again and again is sort of structurally, strategically overcapacity. Obviously, we're having a bit of a restocking event here, but going forward, are we going to see more problems with overproduction and is that going to impact profitability, you know, on a structural basis? And I think the other issue for the battery industry, for the cell industry in particular, is that raw material prices have picked up again. We have an article in BMR this month where we just discuss, have we seen the trough in cell prices? And my contention is that we probably have, because lithium prices up 10-15% off the bottom, nickel prices are up off the bottom, cobalt manganese prices are up off the bottom, maybe graphite prices might pick up at some point, but you look at all of the components of the cell and the raw material prices are off the bottom and raw materials are still a huge component of cell costs, and in fact, an increasing component of cell costs. So you've got to think that cell prices are going to be on the up going forward. And then what does that do to the profitability of battery makers in an oversupplied market?
Interesting you mentioned the lithium. I'm at the Fast Market Seoul Conference. There's a number of lithium producers here, and I haven't seen them smile for quite some time, but a lot of smiles I saw on the conference floor. So a lot of talk about lithium today. You know, it went quiet for about 6 months or more. A lot of interest in lithium again, and the sentiment on the floor is bullish outlook for lithium pricing.
So I understand from the producers I speak to that the phones are back to ringing off the hook again. So, you know, that's a good indication of the health of the lithium market. And there seem to be a number of sort of strategic deals being done. So, I mean, it's very good to see that, particularly given that lithium prices have sort of moved a bit sideways in the last couple of weeks after the first push up. The lithium stocks in particular have drifted off, lithium equities. So I think we announced in the review that we're sort of turning a little bit more bullish on lithium in the near term with this restocking cycle underway. So I think that it's really good to see that the demand industries are starting to realize, well, actually, what we saw over the last 6 months was maybe a sort of a one-off and not so maybe a cyclical rather than a structural issue. And, you know, we're still going to need lots of lithium going forward. And I think one of the points that we pick up in the review this month in the April issue is this issue around lepidolite supply in China. Have you been to lepidolite mines on your tour?
Not on this trip, but previous trips, yes. Yeah. Yes.
The big issue for the lepidolite mines and the difference between this sort of $10 to $15 a kilogram cost level that you hear quoted at the moment, and maybe the $20 to $25 per kilogram level that a lot of experts quote, is really around waste management. And it's how you deal with the processing waste from the mining and processing part of the business. And there is a contention that that processing waste is hazardous waste material. And if it is hazardous waste material, the cost of disposal is around $10 a kilogram. If you can treat that as ordinary waste material, then the cost of disposal is about $1 a kilogram. And that's really the difference in the marginal cost of production that you see being quoted by various commentators. So it's going to be very interesting off the back of these environmental inspections in Jiangxi province at the moment, how the waste material is going to be treated by the national and provincial government. And if it is classified as hazardous waste, straight away, your operating costs for these operations is going to rise quite substantially, I think.
Yeah, that would throw a bit of a spanner in the works for the lepidolite case. Hard to imagine they'll classify it as hazardous waste immediately.
I mean, I think the magnitude of the buildup in waste, I mean, millions and millions and millions and millions of tons of waste just in the 12 to 18 months that these mines have been operating is huge. And if the number of mines, the expansions that have been mooted come through, I mean, we're talking 5 to 10 million tons of waste a year generated by some of these operations. So, you know, I understand that one of the big flagship mines that opened up last year has already filled its first tailings dam with waste material. And you're like sitting there going, whoa, that's a lot of waste material. I think, you know, waste management is going to be the core issue in these lepidolite operations. And the processed tailings have got a lot of quite toxic metals in them, trace elements. And it is going to be very interesting to see how the government sort of treats this, because I think environmental issues have become very much more important among the Chinese population over the last 5 to 10 years or so. And the government has cracked down quite hard on some of these environmental liabilities.
Yeah, I think that's what we saw when the rivers got polluted last year as well. That might have been some fish kill-offs. But this is from lepidolite to LCE, right? Not the lepidolite mining, which is like 18 tons of overburden for one ton of...
Lepidolite mining is also quite impactful in terms of waste because of the lower grade of lepidolite ores. So your average lepidolite ore is maybe 0.3, 0.4% lithium oxide, whereas your average mined spodumene ore in the Western world is sort of like 1.1, 1.2%, three or four times less concentrated. So you are moving a lot of material. But no, this is the processing tailings I'm talking about.
That's quite worrying, all right. I haven't heard much talk about it in China.
I think we're going to have to wait and see, but I think a number of commentators are now looking at their production forecasts and thinking, actually, how viable are some of these expansion projects? So we'll keep a close eye on that. Moving maybe a little bit more downstream now, and obviously we've had the sort of Shanghai Auto Show. We've had some... quite significant sort of relaunches. BYD has kind of relaunched its entire line with these Honor models, which are different trims and substantially lower prices. Tesla upped its prices, and then in the last couple of days, as we record this, has now cut its prices in China. What are you seeing in EV land?
Yeah, it's still topsy-turvy. A little disappointment when Tesla put the prices back up again. When they first started doing that in China, was it maybe 2 years ago? Customers asking for money back if they bought the car the month before. In China, it's not well received, this yo-yo pricing for customers who already paid up. I have seen a lot of the new fleet our BYD stock, very impressive cars right through to the Seal, to the Jin, and now this Honor as well. So BYD really upped their game.
You see that in the sales numbers coming through as well. I mean, I think a lot of the Western analysts look at the sales numbers for the Western companies, and they sort of assume that the EV industry is really struggling. But you look at the Chinese EV sales numbers, and particularly the BYD EV sales numbers, and they look pretty damn robust. So, you know, I think that I get a lot of people coming to me quite regularly saying, well, you know, you're going to cut your EV sales forecasts now. And I'm like, nope. I'm pretty happy with the way things are going, particularly given that this is seasonally the most difficult quarter in the year, and that we expect activity to sort of pick up over the rest of the year. So I'm pretty happy with how things are. The US is difficult market, but it's also a very small market for EVs. Some of the European markets are struggling, but China and the rest of the world going great guns, as we expected them to. And I think the consumer goods trade-in announcements look like being extended to cars as well in some provinces, and can only be positive for EV demand going forward.
As you said, it's a quiet Q1 for NEV sales. I know you're a big fan of NEVs in China, but you know, I think you commented often that there's a big pickup in PHEVs in China as well.
That's been going on for about 12 to 18 months. And one of the things that a lot of people sort of talk about, particularly when it comes to the US, is the huge increase in HEV, so hybrid EV sales. Generally, yeah. Look at hybrids, so HEVs, as an electric vehicle, because it doesn't have a plug. But certainly in China, in hybrid, and also increasingly over the last couple of months, the EREVs, just to give you another title, which is extended range EVs, which is like an EV with a small gasoline motor, which they use to extend the range on the battery. And a lot of people, you know, 4 or 5 years ago were talking about this as the future of electric vehicles, as a really important sort of stand-in technology until we got these battery sizes or battery energy densities up. And it didn't really sort of take off in Europe and the US, but it seems to be taking off really quite strongly in the last sort of 6 months or so in the Chinese market. So it's really interesting to see these sort of technologies that were pushed out because of political drivers, if you will, in the Western markets, starting to gain traction in China. And maybe that means that they'll get a second chance in the Western markets as well.
Yeah, I've seen them in the kind of SUV premium range in China. Li Auto has this extended range vehicle. So the bigger cars, it's been going on in China for a while now, but when you read the model details, it has this extended range option also.
It's great from the point of view of cost, because it's a much smaller battery, much, much smaller battery than you'd normally have in a big SUV. It makes the costs very, very competitive. So, fascinating developments, you know, technology-wise in the Chinese market. And once again, the Chinese market is really leading the Western markets with regards to sort of technology development.
I did have a couple of meetings with Chinese battery producers, who are big ones, and they have technical development plan is quite impressive, what they're planning to do. Not in terms of chemistry, but in terms of format and integration of cells into the packs or into the EVs. Other than Tesla, there's no one close, right?
There isn't, and I think people looking into the market from outside, particularly in Europe and the US, just don't realize the degree of technical innovation. And as you say, you know, we have obviously the chemical innovation with regards to the LFP battery, but it's more the integration within the vehicle and cell to chassis and CTP technology and all of these things which make the energy density of the pack so much more competitive, not just the energy density of the cell.
Yeah, exactly. So I think nearly every new cell I see promoted in China comes with predicted pack energy density also. So it used to be just the cell energy density, and everyone gets excited seeing really high energy densities. And then by the time it's in an EV, it's cut in half. So yeah, the new cells, they come with an estimated pack energy density also, which is more of a useful tool in really evaluating how the cell's going to perform. But focusing a lot on discuss with them LFMP and sodium ion. And it's quite interesting take from the Chinese players. They do agree there's a market, but most of the hype is coming from outside China, especially sodium ion. It won't be a big part of their portfolio towards the end of the decade. Still primarily LFP, little amount of LFMP, more bespoke niche markets, right. NMC, LFP again for them. So I found it interesting. They didn't seem to be aware of the big hype outside China on sodium ion and the threat that the industry was feeling.
That's interesting. And I think one of the other things that we did in this month's BMR was obviously coming back to the potential European tariff structure and obviously harping back to our blog article on LinkedIn about proposing a two-tier tariff structure for Europe, whereby they impose tariffs for EVs retailing at more than 20,000 euros, but then they have a zero tariff regime for EVs retailing at below that level, given the need to pull through mass market potential in the European market. There currently is maybe only one EV that sells in the European market for below 20,000 euros, which is a proper vehicle, which is the Dacia Spring, which right. actually made in China. And we did have a look at Chinese EVs, a selection of Chinese EVs selling around about 10,000 euros a vehicle in China, which could sell at below 20,000 euros a vehicle in the EU. And, you know, we identified, what, 7 or 8 vehicles with round about a 30 kilowatt hour battery size and around about a 250 to 300 kilometer range, all proper cars. And you do look at what China's doing and think, well, it's the leader really for what's possible going forward, I think.
In Europe, we used to make small cars, very small cars. UK, Italy, you know, your Pandas, you know, the Mars Miners, you know, with the...
Well these aren't. These are sort of like SUV crossovers, I mean, but, wow. you know, it's not just BYD making these cars. I mean, obviously the BYD Seagull is on there, but also the Dongfeng Nanobox, which is the equivalent of the Dacia Spring, but also there's cars by Leapmotor, by Chang'an, by Geely, by Netta. So, you know, there's lots of manufacturers making SUV crossovers and hatchbacks and even sedans, small sedans, which could sell below 20,000 euros into the mass market in Europe. And there are currently no European EV manufacturers or car manufacturers making vehicles at that price point. And that's what we need. We need vehicles at that price point because that's what the consumer can afford.
Yeah. Well, if you think of consumers in that price range, I spent a lot of time in Southeast Asia recently, and there's basically nothing but Chinese EVs in the EV scene down there. Even some brands yeah. I've never even seen before. China for them is their primary market. Europe and US is secondary market, and then rest of the world third. But they basically have the rest of the world to themselves. I mean, you have yeah. a couple of Korean EV makers down there, but if they're not allowed into the US, they're going to hoover up the rest of the world because you won't see GM oh, yeah. or Ford.
And I mean, you know, we've seen BYD moving into Brazil. We've seen it moving into Thailand, Indonesia. Yeah. These are all big markets. Obviously, the Indian market is a big market as well. More likely to be sort of joint ventures with Indian companies, I would say. But at the moment, apart from in the luxury end of the business, we don't see any Western automakers really competing in the mass market part of the business. So it's a blank slate for the Chinese companies, I think.
The nicest, we were in Hondas and everything down there, but the nicest car we were in was, I can't remember it, Chinese EV brand that I've never seen before. It was a sedan type car. It's probably a lot less than 20,000 USD or euro because it's in Southeast Asia, but the beautiful car in the interior, great drive. And it's a brand I've never seen. It probably rebranded for the area, but it was a very nice car.
China potentially to clean up in the rest of the world because nobody else is really offering anything. Heard it here first, folks. I guess probably just to sort of finish up, the storage ESS, stationary storage markets continue to be pretty robust. We're seeing some pretty big numbers coming out of really all markets at the end of 2023. I think US ESS deployments hit a record in the fourth quarter. Australian projects hit a record in the whole of 2023. Chinese projects hit a record in 2023. So, I mean, the stationary storage market continues to grow extremely rapidly, and many commentators, myself included, have it as a major driver of cell demand and battery raw materials demand by the end of this decade, we're quite likely to have to take our demand forecast up again. What are you hearing from the cell makers on the ESS market?
This year, primarily more than so than any other years, ESS was a big portion of the revenue for the Chinese battery makers and a big portion of the profits as well. It's an area that they don't need to rely on OEMs for. They can also be, besides selling the cells, they can also sell, and which they do, the full systems, and they have a huge cost advantage there. The price of energy storage systems within China have been crashing, more or less. I mean, they have the price per kilowatt hour of an energy storage system in China is like somewhere between 50 and 60 USD. That is just the 20-foot container itself.
Wow, that's come down a lot, because it was hundreds of dollars per kilowatt hour, even, you know, as little as a year ago. So that's come down a lot. But in some of these markets, like in the US market, it's still a lot more than that. So presumably these Chinese manufacturers are really enjoying selling these 20-foot containers to the US market and to the European markets, where they can charge several hundred dollars a kilowatt hour for cells, which cost probably, what, $40 a kilowatt hour to produce.
The China market's very competitive. So this is a bit of a price war between the players for the Chinese market, which is the transparent bidding auction, which is evaluated by some of it's provincial, so governmental, or you have energy storage deployments, and they bid. So it's transparent. You can see the bids and you can see the costs involved.
And what sort of formats are you seeing for ESS cells? Because obviously we've been hearing over sort of recent years that being sort of developing specific ESS type formats, I mean, is that starting to become the norm now, or with very large cells, or do we still see sort of cylindrical cells? Yeah. Prismatic cells, what are you seeing in terms of that side of things?
Prismatic, very large meaning 300 amp hour. No, so we've moved beyond the 280 amp hour cells, very large cells. So what we've seen in the last 12 months is the typical 20-foot container was about 2.3, 2.5 megawatt hours. Now, CATL just released one this week, same size container, and it's almost double in capacity. And that's all happened in the space of 12 months. The new container is about 5 megawatt hours. You can expect CATL released one 6.2. But a lot of that's come down to the larger format cells, which strip out a lot of the excess periphery in terms of cabling, management systems, environmental systems. The big change was the large format cells, and they're beginning to dominate in China. I'm not sure if we're seeing the really large format cells. That is, some of the ESS providers are 500 amp hour cells. These things are huge. I mean, you need a forklift to move them. I'm not sure if they've made it out into the global arena yet, but they will soon. But okay. Yes, the large format.
What does that mean for sort of second and third tier manufacturers who may have leftover EV type cells that they were hoping to sort of push into the ESS market? I'm really thinking from an inventory backlog point of view. We've obviously seen a big build up in inventories over the last couple of years. Are those cell inventories still potentially usable, or are they effectively just going to have to go for recycling?
They're probably going to end up recycling. One of the goals, or what appears to be what's happening here, there's a huge cell war price in China. CATL can afford to make cells cheaper and a higher quality than the tier two, tier threes. The tier two, tier threes in this current cycle, price war, are operating at a loss, could be driven out of the market if this continues. So it's a very tough time for tier two, tier threes, because historically the big guys weren't that interested in the energy storage market, and now they're flooding it, and it's very hard to compete with them, especially the prices also. So, you know, you'd hardly want to risk integrating a whole bunch of smaller cells from a tier three when you can get a state-of-the-art from CATL for the same price.
And obviously, what do you think that means for that capacity, a lot of which has been built in the last few years? Could that be bought and adapted by the bigger guys, or is that effectively going to close down and not be used?
I think most of the capacity is from the big guys, right? When you lay it all out, most of the capacity is BYD, CATL, and there's a pretty steep drop off when you get to the next guys. I mean, top 10 for me, battery producers in China, other than capacity, are tier one. The tier two, T3s, we don't even talk about, you know, it's the household names.
What about the ones that kind of are kind of household names, like sort of, I mean, just as pick some names like Kaob and Farasis and Goshen and guys like that. Where do they sort of fit in? Do they?
They're right up there. They're competing. So for me, they wouldn't be tier two, but they build high quality cells. They're building the big cells. They can make energy storage units. So that capacity will be used up from other battery companies who aren't CATL or BYD. Yeah, so that's not going to recycle. And they have been making, so the traditional energy storage cell was 100 amp hour. That's kind of been gone for the market for a few years now. It's 280 in a minimum cell format. And that's big enough to be incorporated. That wouldn't be, if there's excess inventory of 280, that wouldn't be recycled. Most of that's LFP. But, and then for EVs, of course, they all have their own partnerships with the OEMs, and that capacity is really determined by the OEM. So if they made it, they have a customer for it.
So it's really the sort of like the regional players that may have been sponsored by a regional government or something like that, that are just stuck in one province, and the very small players that are likely to fall by the wayside.
Yeah. So the hundreds of battery makers that appeared over the last 10, 15 years, consolidation for sure, the market. I mean, it's, I think someone asked you a question today, it might be more suited to you, Matt, was when are batteries going to become a commodity, or are they a commodity? But there's going to be big players, and that's it, in China, especially, because you don't need those diverse supply, especially with the supply base also is a big concern, right, globally. Now, with EU battery passport and the IRA, these smaller guys couldn't afford to kind of put the resources into accurately detailing and tracing their entire supply chain. So it's quite difficult for those guys as well.
That's really interesting. Okay, well, we will call it a day there. And I will say thanks very much to Cormac for joining us from Korea. I will flag that we will both are intending to be at the Fast Markets Conference in Las Vegas in June. If you're there, please come up and introduce yourself and say hi to us.
Yeah, look forward to seeing you there, Matt, and whoever wants to meet us together.
The nice thing is we don't get recognized very much walking around, which is probably a good thing. But thanks very much, Cormac, and speak next month.
Talk to you next month.
So that brings us to the end of our podcast for April. As always, you can get more detail on all of the topics we've discussed, and indeed many more that we don't have time to discuss on a monthly basis, in the latest issue of Battery Materials Review, which you can find at www.batterymaterialsreview.com. I'm Matt Fernley, editor of Battery Materials Review, and this has been Recharge. Thanks for listening.